And so we begin Poetry Month on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Gail Ryan is not only the author of a book, but she's won some awards with haiku as well. We'll meet her today on Scribble.
Gail, I've known you for a little bit more than a dozen years or so, and in that time you have morphed from artist to poet to local historian and now to biography. So why don't we begin at the end and talk about the biography that you've just completed or in the process of completing and trying to get published.
My biography is of Edwin Willard Deming, who lived from 1860, the beginning of the time of the Civil War, and died in 1942, the beginning of World War II. And during that time, he created art, and his main goal was to visit all of the Indian tribes and to be able to paint and sketch and sculpt what their life had been like before the reservations. He wanted to keep that alive. And so I am on the Geneseo Historical Museum Board, and we have several of his paintings, we have oils and also watercolors. And I became interested in reintroducing him to Geneseo, because Geneseo is where he spent from age 6 months to 23 when he left to go study art in New York and then in Paris. So I'm going to read this quote that President Theodore Roosevelt wrote in a letter to Edwin W. Deming. Quote, "When all other artists are dead and gone and their work with them, two will remain to represent American art, and those are Frederick Remington and E.W. Deming." Unfortunately, he was only half right. The number of people who remember Remington are great. I think a lot of it has to do with the Remington gun and so forth. And yet, when you ask even people from Geneseo, because there are no Demings left in Geneseo, nobody, you know, they'll shake their head no, but they knew Remington. So I decided I was going to do something about it.
Everyone has interesting, you know, reasons for picking a subject, but had you written biographies before? Was it just an impulse to get this man into the public world again?
I have done extensive historical research. When I did grand excursion on the Upper Mississippi River by Curtis Roseman, he and his wife edited that, and I wrote the chapter about the logging industry rafting the logs down the river and then to the sawmills all along the Mississippi to as far as St. Louis. And as a result of that, I then did programs. I did extensive PowerPoint programs. Actually gave my program to the Weyerhaeuser family when they had when they were here for a short time, a reunion. It was, of course, and so then it morphed out of that into finding more information just about Weyerhaeuser, and I then began giving programs, biographical programs about him and what he did. I then also did biographical work with David Sears. I was one of four people who did Forgotten Founders at the Comm University several years ago, and I gave my 1 week biographical sketch of David Sears. So I've done Catherine Sedgwick, the author. I've done other. I mean, I've done several biographical mm-hmm. programs. This is the first biography that I've ever written.
And you're trying to get it published.
And right? I'm trying to get it published.
And I imagine one of the problems with publishing an artist is that the illustrations have to be in color.
Yes, they do. I mean,
and that's expensive.
Yes, it is. It is. But Roald has suggested maybe Kickstarter. I think his son used that to get his program going, his project going. The thing about Deming that I want to bring out is that there are a lot of painters, you know, early 20th century painters who painted Indians. I mean, it was very popular at the time. But everything you read about him is that he was able to get inside to the Indians' life and into their psyches and their way of living. These are quotes from what I have found about him. And the reason, one said, is that when he grew up on a farm north of Geneseo, the Indian boundary line was in north in Henry County. It ran very close to where their farm was. And the Sauk Meskwaki had lived there, of course, before the treaties and then the banishment to across the river to Iowa. Even though there were no Indians there permanently, the Winnebago Indians came down from Wisconsin every year while he was young, and they would hunt and trap and fish in the Rock River. And then he got to know these people, and he loved sitting around listening to their stories, and he played, and you know, they would play games with bow and arrows, and he became very adept at that. So
how come he got lost in the shuffle?
Well, the only thing that I can say is, in thinking about it, is that with the fact that he is writing, I mean, excuse me, he is painting at a time period where we have the Civil War, and then comes the Depression, the Prohibition, there becomes world, you know, all of these matters, because the Indians were suffering, as far as he would go out and he would find, and he'd come back and have help for these Indians. Especially he was tied in, well, they had adopted him, the Sioux had adopted him, the Crow, and also the Piegan Blackfeet in Montana. And when he went up to see the Blackfeet, he saw tuberculosis, and he saw terrible things that were occurring because of this environment that the United States had allowed to occur, you know?
Sheer neglect as much as anything else.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he worked very hard on that, and he was very successful. He has five of his paintings are in the Smithsonian. The Gilcrease Museum in Tulsa has 44 of his paintings. They have the largest number. Metropolitan Museum has two of his sculptures, and there are about 30. I have investigated and found 35 other museums. I was very close to the Whitney's and in New York, but evidently, you know, that the time period just seemed to be people were more intent on just living through that era.
Have you thought about university presses? It would seem to me that something of this nature might appeal to a university press.
Yes, I have. And I actually should probably, I have my expository degree from Iowa. I was one of the first group that went through that had, you could have a degree in, say, science and expository. I had mine in English literature and expository. So I have a degree from Iowa. I don't know if that would make any difference. But then also I could also, you know, contact Tulsa. I mean,
I would think Oklahoma or Wyoming
would
be more interesting.
I wouldn't,
would be places to.
Wouldn't shortchange Illinois publishers either, because it's in this area. And university presses do scholarly, historical mm-hmm. works. It is true that they might favor their own faculty members, but that's not exclusive. They publish a lot of different things. But something of this sort, which is going to require an investment because of the color plates, mm-hmm. I would think that would be something university presses might be a little more amenable to.
Don't give up.
No.
I just turned out that A Wrinkle in Time was turned down by 26 publishers.
Oh, my.
Well, look at A Confederacy of Dunces.
Yeah.
That was universally condemned until Walter Percy read it and laughed and got it published by a university press.
Right.
So, you know, there are ways, and you should keep going, because he sounds an interesting person.
He is. He's very interesting, and he's... And he had a lot of connections while during his lifetime, you know, as far as people recognizing him for what he did. I have the one thing that I've added to also to is that the two biographies that I based on, one was in 1925 and one was 1978. And so I have I found some letters at New York Library that he had written home. So, I mean, I have some new material that's not anyplace else.
Very good. Well, it sounds as if you are well-versed in biography. But what I don't understand is how you took a detour from books to poetry on behalf of the Carp.
Well, from art. You were an artist when I knew you, and then all of a sudden I discovered you. In fact... because I want to be sure to get this in. The first I had any inkling that you wrote poetry was I was judging a Mississippi Valley writer's poetry contest, and this one poem just sort of stuck out at me, and it turned out to be Gail Ryan's poem. And if we don't get anything else done in this short time, I'd like to have your audience hear this poem.
Okay,
listen to it carefully, because I have a question after this.
It's entitled Prairie View. Far from the Illinois highway, farmsteads with windbreaks grafted on the soil, silhouette small and scorched against the dusk red sky. Wind scours the April earth, God's country. Land so flat it would seem the devil has nowhere to hide. Generations have scratched dirt and coaxed seeds with prayers, potlucks, and crossed fingers in pockets. Tight bargains made with whomever. Bargains for rain, for bounded rows, complete, contained, controlled. Their cowled eyes ignore distant echoes from ancient wooded ravines, Dionysian dance floors, circling, circling.
Now, I have a question for you, Don.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that a comforting poem or a disturbing one?
I just think it's arresting.
Well, it is. I know, but what makes it arresting?
The fact that I was struck by images through it. You know, so flat the devil has no place to hide. Then you bring in Dionysus and so on. So you're fooling around with a lot of things on a landscape and drawing different ideas and images from it. But whether it's disturbing or unsettling, I just find it fascinating.
Well, Jean Hirschfield suggests that a good poem ought to be both. And here's her phrase. When I just read Jean Hirschfield's book, and I'll talk about her when we recommend books. One of the things Jane Hirschfield says, she's a one of my favorite three or four living poets, is that no good poem is ever entirely safe. this is not a safe poem, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's
true. It's creepy in a way, and at the same time, there's this beautiful, idyllic farm scene. But
I'm not going to suggest that you're creepy and that you are drawn to it.
No good poem is entirely safe. There's always a dark edge. And what really captivated me about that poem is the dark edge. Mm-hmm. Are your haikus like that, too?
No.
Her haikus are funny.
Well, not funny.
I guess I'm thinking of the limerick.
Oh, that's the limerick, yes. Yeah. And, of course, I am from Moline originally. Yeah. You know, that was the funny one.
How did you happen to get into the haiku business, though? Was it the Big River?
I think you told me about this contest.
Right.
And so I just simply wrote my haiku, which only won third place. But I always start with an image. Because being an artist, I see things and then things develop out of that, you know. So when this poem do you want me to read the one that won? And this is, you have to remember that this is between Geneseo and Atkinson where I saw this, okay? Carp in strip mine pond swim round with flashes of gold. Land renewed, alive.
That carries a lot with it right there.
To me, from what I understand as a haiku, is you pretty much have an image and then somehow you take it someplace else and maybe an idea or a concept or an awareness rolled. Yeah. What is your idea?
Well, I think that's right, yeah. And I think this one, too, isn't entirely safe. Right? I mean, I think there's a dark edge.
Well, in the fact that it's a strip mine land on a pond.
Yeah.
Yeah. That the carp is living there.
Right.
And we live in strip mined areas. Right. And it's not entirely safe.
You were an artist first and then a poet?
Yes, and I must have left my that book that I showed you back on the other. But I have a whole. I took a course with Dick Stahl and Bill Hannon, and we did a chapbook. And I did month by month a view from looking out my sunroom through each month. And I wish I had it because they're really great ones. I mean, I love the
woodcuts
haikus.
And then a haiku that go
yeah,
with it.
I use my artwork and then my haikus with it.
I've often wondered about haiku. They've doubled the syllables in Twitter. I wonder if they're going to expand haiku now.
There is a kind that it's not called haiku, but there is a kind that, and I forget the name of it.
Haibon?
No, I don't know. No, what is?
I don't know either. But you've also entered a limerick and got the bronze medal on that too.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
There once was a girl from Moline whose passion for fishing was keen. She held her line tight, waited long for a bite, but a carp left her hook very clean.
I did fish when I was young. My grandfather took me out fishing out down to Sylvan Slough.
What impact does early experience in nature have on a person?
Oh, I think it's you carry with that with you all of those images at any time you're making comparisons and trying to understand the now with the then and
You know, it's true that at one time people lived in the country. Most of the people in this country grew up on farms or in small towns. Now people are born and never get away from concrete, and you wonder how they are going to be able to relate to the earth.
Exactly.
And yet the earth is our mother. And well, I must say, Gail, you have had a very interesting background. You have a book that deserves to be published, and I wish you all the success in the world with that. In the meanwhile, of course, keep writing haiku.
Thank you.
escorting Gail out, I grabbed a look at that little chapbook to which you referred, and I wanted to see what she had for April. Breezes from the north, wind chimes play the April air, magnolia flesh falls.
Ooh.
Danger in that one, too.
Magnolia flesh, yes.
Uh-huh. And yes, she has a picture in that one with just a spot of color in it.
I'd never thought of magnolia flesh, but that's exactly what falls, that thick, sticky stuff that comes out before the leaves.
But calling it flesh
is
very interesting.
Yes.
It's funny how that goes. I don't know what, thinking about memory or something, and the image came to me that, you know, when you lose things, I thought, well, maybe cells are seeping through my brain and deepening the fissures. And then I thought, deciduous dendrites, from the ends of which these memories fall, like branches of a tree. And I thought, I think I'll sit down and write something I can put that into.
Right.
So I wrote something that doesn't amount to anything, but it was just, you know, one of those things. But when an image occurs to you, those are just gifts.
Yeah.
Just gifts. Sometimes they're great images and other times they aren't. But it's fascinating what you can do with language. And doing with language in a strict form like a haiku is quite demanding. Twitter is much easier.
Right.
And less inspiring most times.
Well, and that, you know, that's what's wrong with Hallmark cards, too. They're pleasant, right? Mm-hmm. But there's no dark edge.
Well,
there's no flesh falling.
I got a wonderful, wonderful birthday card from one of my daughters. You're 1 year older. You're approaching an age when a life sentence isn't such a big deal.
Whoa.
And then she added, so go do something illegal. My children are totally undisciplined. There is a book that everyone ought to read. We badly need to cure ourselves. But it's not just us, it's the whole world. And the book is by Amy Chua, who is very insightful in all her writings. But Political Tribes, Group Instinct, and the Fate of Nations. It's amazing as we are developing this consciousness of one world. Astronauts come back forever changed.
Right.
Because they see what a unique place this is, and we all are the same. Forget this business of skin color, culture, religion, all that. We are all the same. Get over the differences. But we can't. We have these tribal instincts. And in the United States, it has just been disturbing how those tribal differences have been worked politically.
Well, and we thought a lot of them were had evaporated, but they were apparently just below the surface.
Oh, no. As a Southerner, I knew. You know, everyone celebrated Obama's election as president, and I thought, this is going to stir up racial hatred like nothing.
Right.
And it did.
Right.
The number of hate groups doubled in his first year in office.
Right.
Guns were being purchased at a record rate. I mean, that's alarming. But I noticed when she's talking about American exceptionalism, the whole idea of America is we're not going to pay any attention to religion, background, anything. But as people came in, attention was paid. We still have those tribal instincts. But this little graph, in 1960, foreign-born residents of the United States were distributed principally as follows. Italy, 1,000,002. Canada, 953,000. Germany, 990,000. England, 833,000. Poland, 748,000. 1960. 40 years later, Mexico, 7,800,000. China, 1,300,000. Philippines, 1,200. India, 1,000. Cuba, 952,000. Those are dramatic numbers.
Right.
And those dramatic changes have just stirred the pot fiercely. And yet that's what America was about. You could come here and, you know, we would all be accepted. And it's not because everybody coming here has to behave in a certain way. As she points out, you have to celebrate your differences or it's never going to work.
Right.
The problem is that it's not just in this country. It's all over the
world. Well, I think, you know, I grew up, as you did too, with the idea that this was a melting pot.
Yeah.
And that phrase, that comes from a play, in fact, in which there's a huge cauldron of melted steel on the stage, and workers in their native costumes come in one end of the stage from all these different countries, and when they emerge on the other end, they're all wearing overalls and carrying lunch buckets and stuff. But as of, you know, and I started teaching in the 1960s when that metaphor of the melting pot was changing into what I think it is and ought to be, the patchwork quilt.
Mm-hmm.
Our strength, is our differences.
Yeah,
I mean, Hitler thought we would be an easy pick because we were all so different, whereas his well-oiled war machine, you know, was absolutely uniform. Well, he discovered, in fact, that to have in the same foxhole an Italian, an Irishman, and an African-American sometimes had some advantages.
Oh, yeah, and he stupidly started killing off Jews, Gypsies,
right.
Ukrainians. I mean, Poles, that's insane. That's just insane. But that insanity rises from very primitive instincts. And the United States was supposed to overcome those instincts. We were supposed to forget that stuff. And yet there are people now who insist that we have to be a Christian nation. And we have to be in Islam. The great drive there is that all has to be Islamic. Reading Ehrman's book on the rise of Christianity, he talks a lot about the pagans, how tolerant they were.
Right.
They didn't care what religion you had. As a matter of fact, they were kind of interested in it. And if you were different, they were interested in that. We have to have something like that. We have to develop some kind of tolerance. And if you want to see the depth of the problem, read Political Tribes by Amy Chua. It is a very informative book. I found it rather disturbing. Although I'm an optimist, it made me feel a little pessimistic because I wonder, can we ever get past this stuff? Quit looking at people's differences. The things that bind us together are the fact that we are all essentially the same. And you can't keep that in your mind. You can't keep the country together. So with that, I think I'll stop breathing heavily.
Okay.
We'll head on out. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week for another edition of Scribble in Poetry Month.